Straight out of Philly, this is the Reluctant Theologian Podcast.
Oh, so reluctant.
I am your host, Dr. R.T. Mullins from the University of Lucerne. Are you of two minds about which model of the Incarnation to adopt? Perhaps you are looking for someone who can offer an account of the Incarnation that will fix it, not mix it. You might be in luck. Today, my Palm Beach interns and I interviewed Dr. Tim Paul on the metaphysics of the Incarnation. If you'd like to support the show, you can donate money to my Patreon account or my Ko-fi account. Any donation amount helps me out in so many ways. I greatly appreciate all the support that people have already offered. If you have questions or topics you'd like to hear on the show, you can send me a message at rtmullins.com. Well, ready or not, here we are chatting about God incarnate. Enjoy. Okay, so I am sitting here with Timothy Paul and my summer interns, Andrew Drinkard and Drew Mercantini. So everyone say hello to the audience, tell them your name, and so that way everybody can get familiar with the sound of your voices.
Hi, my name is Andrew Drinkard, and I'm excited to be here.
Hi, my name is Drew Mercantini, and I'm also excited to be here.
Hi, I'm Tim Paul, and I also am excited to be here.
So let's get into the incarnation stuff here. So the first thing I need you to do, Tim, is if you could just remind us, the audience and everybody, what this traditional Chalcedonian statement is like regarding Christ's incarnation. And then once you tell us that, could you maybe tell us what this metaphysical problem is for the doctrine of the incarnation?
Sure, happy to. According to Chalcedon, the Fourth Ecumenical Council, it's in 451 AD. According to Chalcedon, Christ is one person who has two natures. He has the one divine nature, which is the very same nature had by the Father and the Holy Spirit. And he has a complete human nature composed of a rational soul and a body. And these two natures are distinct things. They're brought together in one person, but they're distinct things. And that union into which they're brought is sometimes called the hypostatic union. Hypostatic just because they've come together, those two natures come together in the hypostasis of the person. And I think we'll probably talk about what that means a bit more later. But that's the general metaphysics of the councils. And the main metaphysical worry or problem that comes up is you might think that, well, anything that's divine has to have certain features, like a divine thing has to be impassible, maybe, or immutable, or omniscient, or omnipotent, or omnipresent, or take any divine prerogative. Seems like anything that's really worthy of the title of being divine has to have those features. But likewise, seems like anything that's really a human like me or you, has to be, well, ignorant of some things, has to come into existence at a certain time, has to be non-eternal, has to be changeable and affectable. And so it seems like all the things you have to be God, at least many of those are things you can't be to be a human. But if that's all true, then you can't have one person be both divine and human. If he's divine and human, he both has and lacks all those features, and that's, of course, impossible. So you're wrong when you think he's incarnate. That's the main worry.
Yeah, so as you mentioned earlier, there's this term hypostasis that floats around in this conversation, and it seems to be pretty technical. So could you walk us through the technical definition of that term, as well as person, which we're probably more familiar with, but not in the sense that it's being used, as understood by the councils? And maybe you could help us understand how this maps onto our current definitions of person, and maybe we would say nature instead of hypostasis.
Sure, happy to. So hypostasis or a supposit, those are synonyms from Greek and Latin respectively. Hypostasis is, as you point out, it's a technical term in these discussions. And it took some time for it to get regimented to mean precisely one thing. In fact, just yesterday I was reading in the Theodoret of Cyrus, where he uses the term hypostasis to refer to a nature, which, as you'll see, is not the way it's talked about these days. So it took a while to get all honed in, but the traditional usage, the regimented usage it finally came to, in that usage, a hypostasis is something like the largest ontological whole there, the biggest substantial unity there. So, you know, the whole tree, or the whole dog, or the whole human, or maybe the whole bronze statue, not just the dog's paw, and not just the roots of the tree, but the whole thing. The whole is the hypostasis. And it's not a mere part of something else, and it couldn't be on this technical definition. Just like no husband has a husband part, so likewise no hypostasis has a hypostasis part. So if you have a hypostasis, you've got a maximally large substantial whole there. Just like if you have a substance that's a husband, you've got the whole substance being a husband, not just half of me or just my heart, however romantic that might be. That's not what the husband is. So that's what a hypostasis is, the largest ontological whole. When you have one of those that's rational, unlike the dog, unlike the bronze statue, unlike the tree, when you have a hypostasis that's rational, then you have what they call a person. So a person is a hypostasis that's the genus that's under the larger group, and what differentiates it from all other hypostases is being rational. So that's the way those two terms are used in the traditional discussion of these concepts. How about a nature? Well, nature is said in lots of different ways. If you read Aristotle in the book Delta, the Metaphysics, it's this philosophical lexicon there. And he defines the term nature. He gives four options, but he says the proper one says this. The nature is, quote, the essence of those things which contain in themselves as such a source of motion. I'll say more about that in a sec for sure. But he goes on to say that nature in this sense is the source of motion in natural objects, which is somehow inherent in them, either potentially or actually. What's that mean? Well, you could think of nature in this sense, the Aristotelian sense, as something really a subject there that is that in virtue of which it can act in certain ways. It's the source of its activity. So in this sense, it's called sometimes the concrete sense of nature. The nature is the Christ's body and soul. It's the body and soul together that makes the human nature of Christ. There's another sense of nature. It's called the abstract sense. And in the abstract sense, a nature is something more like a property or a feature or a shareable thing. So the nature of me would be humanity itself. And of course, since you guys are all human too, we each share that one humanity, which is humanity itself in this abstract sense. In the councils, I think the more common sense, I think the sense they do in fact use is the concrete sense. For two reasons. One is, like I've already said, they'll sometimes call the nature something like flesh enlivened by a rational soul. And that makes sense of the concrete usage, but it doesn't make any sense at all if you're thinking of it like a property or a shareable universal. And secondly, they'll talk about the nature of Christ as being hung on a cross, as bleeding for our sins, and as suffering, in fact, they'll say of the nature. And here, again, that makes sense of a concrete thing that's really made out of flesh. But it doesn't make any sense at all to say that the abstract, universal, shareable property of humanity itself hung on a cross. So I think in the contemporary usage, nature is typically used in that more abstract sense. But in the traditional usage you find in these Christological disputes, nature is used in the more concrete sense.
Great, that was helpful. Now, while the expression two natures, one person is somewhat common in this discussion, the term hypostatic union is not so much. So maybe you could explain the significance of this and just maybe the role it serves in the doctrine.
Sure, yeah. So the hypostatic union, that's a technical term of art, kind of like hypostasis is. So I think it's a term of art and it's meant to convey that you have two things united together in a third thing. You got nature one, say the divine nature, and nature two, the human nature, and they're joined together within the hypostasis or the person of the Son, of the Word. So that's the basic idea of what the hypostatic union is. It's that union of one nature to the other in the person of the Word. And what does it do? What functions does it serve? Well, a couple. One thing is that it explains why it is that you really only have one person there. So, for instance, in the hypostatic union, you've got the two natures combined together into a one larger ontological whole, the hypostasis of the Word. But if being a person, like I said earlier, requires being a hypostasis, and the human nature of Christ isn't itself a hypostasis because it's not a whole, it's more of a part than a whole. So likewise, you can say that the human nature of Christ isn't a person. And if you want the metaphysics undergirding that, you point to the hypostatic union. A second thing the hypostatic union does is it explains the communication of idioms. We want to know why we're allowed to say things like this. Paul says in Scripture that if they had known who he was, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of glory. And some thinkers have said, well, wait a second. The crucified thing is like the human nature. That's the thing that hangs on a cross. And the Lord of glory, that's like the divine thing. And how can you say that the Lord of glory is the thing that was crucified? Here, in response, thinkers have said, well, look, the thing we name by Lord of Glory, by that phrase, is the very same thing we name by the thing when we say it was crucified. It's one and the same person there that we're naming that did both. And so you can say, drawing a word from one nature, like Lord, from the divine nature, you can say the Lord died. That's true, because it's one person that was both Lord and died. And you can say something like the creator of the stars was a man. That's true as well, according to traditional Catholic thought, at least, because the person who created the stars was the Word, and that very same Word became flesh and became a man. And what allows you to make these sort of linguistic moves is the communication of idioms, which is undergirded metaphysically by the hypostatic union.
So I want to talk about the hypostatic union a little bit more. Whenever we're talking about this, I'm always curious, like, how many minds and how many wills there are in these different views. And so on your understanding of the incarnation, I want to know how many minds and wills there are in Jesus Christ. You're probably going to want to tell the audience what you mean by mind and will, like, when we're having these kind of conversations.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So what I mean by them is something like this. When I think of the mind, I think of that as a functional term. And by a functional term, I just mean it names whatever it is that plays a certain role or a function. And what's the function? Well, the mind is that whatever it is, that thing which is aimed at knowing the truth. That's the role of the mind. It's the thing which functions to know the truth. And we might disagree. You might think it's just a soul, and someone else might think it's just a brain. We can all speak of the mind in this functional sense, because no matter what the ontology underneath it is, we all think there's something or other there in virtue of which you and I seek to know the truth, that thing we use for it. I think similarly with will. So if the mind is that which is aimed toward the true, I think the will is that which is aimed toward the good. And again, you can say whatever it is in a person that aims toward choosing the good or willing the good, that's the will. Okay, so that's what I mean by those two terms. I just use them primarily functionally. Now, how many does Christ have of each of those? Well, we know he's the divine person. And so we know that he's got whatever sort of divine apparatus the Father and the Spirit have for knowing and loving and willing and choosing. So he's got to at least have the divine whatnots to do that. And you might think that he's got different faculties, or you might be a simplicity theorist and think it's the one nature that does both these things. That doesn't matter so much here. Maybe it will later in discussion, but for now, you just have to think he's got those divine bits and bobs, whatever they might be, in virtue of which he wills and chooses and knows. Does he get any human ones is the question. And I think the answer ought to be yeah. He gets human ones too. And here's why. My willing and my knowing are two things that are essential to what it is to be a human. And if Christ really assumed all of what it is to be human, he pulled up into himself not just the fleshy business of Tim Paul, but also the mind. And he's saving the whole of me. He's taking up the whole of humanity into himself. And so he's got to have that in virtue of which humans will, and that in virtue of which humans seek the truth. To deny that he has those things is an old heresy, and it's called Apollinarianism. The idea is a guy named Apollinarius thought the person of the Word played the role of the soul in Christ. So you had a fleshy body with no human soul at all, and the Word playing the role of the human soul. And the objection has always been, if he doesn't assume the whole human, he's not saving the whole human. So I think you should say that he has two minds and two wills there for those reasons.
I'd like to go back to this term you used earlier, this phrase, probably another term of art, the communication of idioms. So could you just walk us through that a little bit more, particularly and unpack what that's doing for our understanding of the incarnation?
Yeah, for sure. I think the place to start for the communication of idioms is at the Council of Ephesus in 431, and maybe just before it in the dialogue going on between Nestorius, the Archbishop of Constantinople, and Cyril of Alexandria, the Archbishop of Alexandria. So there, Cyril was pushing Nestorius to affirm something Nestorius wanted to deny. And the thing he wanted to deny was the claim that Mary was the mother or the bearer of God. In Greek, it was Theotokos, God bearer. And what he wanted to say was she was the human bearer, and even she was the Christ bearer. But he didn't want to say that she was the God bearer. And his thought was, it's unseemly to say that Mary bore God, because to say that is to make God himself the sort of thing that can be born, to predicate of God of being born. And Cyril, in response, said, that's quite right. We are predicating of God that he was born. We're not predicating of the divine nature itself, that it somehow passed through the Blessed Virgin Mary, but we are saying that the person was born. And so what they needed was some account for why it is that you can take some claims that are only really satisfied in virtue of one nature, like he suffered or he's God, and say those of the whole person, even saying them in the same breath with some claims that are true only because of the other nature. Like the example I gave earlier, the Lord of Glory was crucified. And so the communication of idioms is just the understanding of the principle whereby you can take terms true of one nature and say it of the person. And I guess importantly, you could say that the communication of idioms allows you to go for some predicates from the nature to the person. So the nature suffered, so Christ suffered. But it doesn't allow you to go from nature to nature. So you can't say the human nature suffered, therefore the divine nature suffered. Or the divine nature is impassable, therefore the human nature is impassable. It's like a trickle-down economy where the downness goes to the person from the natures.
I want to return to something we mentioned earlier in the episode, Tim. Part of your work involves addressing logical problems for the incarnation. So, for example, you give a particular version of the objection to the Chalcedonian doctrine from impassibility. Could you lay that objection out for us, just for the audience, so you could familiarize us with that?
Sure. The objection with respect to impassibility goes like this. You might think anything that's divine is impassible, and anything that's human is passable, is able to be causally affected. But nothing is both passable and impassible. I mean, that sounds like a contradiction straightforwardly. And so it follows that Christ himself is not passable and not impassible. But since anything that's divine is impassible and Christ isn't that, Christ's not divine. And since anything that's human is passable and Christ's not that, it follows that Christ's not impassable. So the basic problem here is just you've got these two claims which seem contradictory put together, and they seem to follow from being both divine and human. And so it follows that that one guy can't be both divine and human. But since the council says he is, so much the worse for the council.
That's good. And now that we've kind of laid out the objection and we've walked through some of these terms, especially the communication of idioms, can you give us your response to this objection and how you work out what the councils are saying?
Yeah, so if you look back at the premises I gave, the first two were anything divine is impassable and anything human is passable. And those two strike me as true. I know there's the dispute about whether divine things have to be impassable, but I think the councils clearly teach that Christ was impassable. So if you spot me for now, the councils, just let me assume it for argument's sake and move forward. I think I gotta accept those first two premises. The next premise was nothing is both impassable and passable. And from those three, the last two claims followed, the therefore claims followed. So I think the logic works. I think two of the three premises are true. The only place left for me to push, to object to, is that third premise, nothing can be both passable and impassable, which might at first have seemed to be the most obvious of the premises. So it's you're pushing to a hard spot having to deny that premise. But I think you can, and I think there's a way to do it. You might ask yourself what it means to say that anything is impassable and what it means to say anything is passable. And here's an early way of doing it, or one way of doing it, that I think fails and we should not do. So you might think that to be impassable is just to be not causally affectable, period, no matter what. And to be passable is just to be causally affectable in some way or other. Now, if that's what you mean by those two terms, I think it's hopeless to try to deny that third premise. The third premise says nothing is both, and if the terms are defined such that one is just the opposite of the other, well, yeah, nothing can be both. That seems true. So I think that's not the way to do it. But what if we understand those terms in a different way? So here I've used an analogy in some of the written work I've done. Think of it like this. Suppose we live in a society where everybody has just one arm. All of us, everybody has just one arm. And we've never known somebody with two arms. We've never met somebody with two arms. Maybe there's a fable of a guy with two arms, but we've never really even heard of such a thing happening. So suppose that's happening. And suppose in this land where we live, there are terms we use. Like I'll say I'm arm bent. And when I say I'm arm bent, I just mean that my one arm is bent more than 90 degrees. It's like you ever ask a little kid to flex and show you his bicep? And he does it. He's arm bent there. And he's also probably pretty cute there too. That's cute when they do that. On the other hand, we have a predicate non-arm bent. And you say that of somebody when his arm is bent less than 90 degrees. So like little kids in a classroom raising their hand when they want to answer the question, they're non-arm bent. I think those predicates make sense, arm bent and non-arm bent. And I think I know how to use them in that society. And I think it's pretty clear nothing can be both, because if you all have just one arm, that one arm can't be both bent more than 90 degrees and not bent more than 90 degrees. But what if, now we're changing the story a bit, what if somebody with two arms comes into the story? What if you have a visitor from a foreign land? What if an alien comes? I mean, who cares? But what if you get a person there with two arms? Then what can you say about him? In that case, when he has two arms, it seems like he does satisfy the conditions, or at least he could satisfy the conditions for being both arm bent and non-arm bent at the same time. He's got two arms. He could be flexing his bicep with one and raising his hand with the other. And in such a case, he's got one arm that's not bent 90 degrees and another one that is. And so one person could be both arm bent and non-arm bent at the same time, with those terms meaning the same thing, just in virtue of his having two arms. And I bet you can see how that applies to the incarnation case. We live in a world of one-natured things. And maybe most of us have never even heard of a two-natured thing, or maybe some of us think it's just a fable that there's a two-natured thing. But if something of two-natured came into the system, I think it could fulfill the conditions for having a nature that can be causally affected, if it has a human nature like yours or mine, which can be causally affected. And it can fulfill the conditions for having a nature that can't be causally affected, if it has the divine nature. And so you have one person, one thing, satisfying both those terms at the same time. And so I think that analogy shows a way of understanding those terms, passable and impassable. To be impassable doesn't mean to be not causally affectable no matter what, period. To be impassable means to have a nature that can't be causally affected. And to be passable doesn't mean to be able to be changed no matter what, period. It means to have a nature that's changeable. And once we say it like that, we can see how one person can satisfy both those predicates. And so premise three of that argument I gave, the one that says nothing can be both passable and impassable, turns out to be false. That's what I think anyway.
Good stuff, good stuff. So I want to throw another objection at you here. So this is sometimes called the two sons worry, or more popularly known as Nestorianism. So the objection, it goes a little something like this. So a human person is a soul in a body. And if the sun assumes a soul in a body, then the sun is assuming a human person. Since the sun is already a person, and the sun is now assuming a human person, we're going to have two persons, two people in Jesus Christ. But we were only supposed to have one, just one person there, and now we've got two. Like, so this is one too many. So Tim, like, how are you going to avoid this problem?
Yeah, good. Thank you. I think of it like this. Your first premise was a human person is composed of body and soul. And in one sense, I affirm it. In another sense, I deny it. Or you didn't even say compose. You said a human person is a body and soul. And if you mean a human person is identical to a body and soul, that's just what the thing is. It's identical. I'm going to deny it. But if you mean it's just composed of a body and soul, I'm going to accept it. Now, composition works like this. We know that you can have two things which together compose a third in some cases. But if you add more stuff on, they no longer compose a third. So for instance, if you've got a little chapel, like a little log cabin chapel, that can be a building. But if you build another building on top of that chapel, such that that chapel is just one wall of the building, we typically think you've got just a single building there, not two buildings there anymore. And the idea is once it's part of a larger building, it ceases being its own building. Like if you had to get insurance, you get insurance on one building, not two buildings there. So I think likewise, personhood is like being a building. Being a building is a maximal claim such that no smaller part like the room I'm sitting in counts as a building in and of itself. So likewise, personhood is a larger thing such that no smaller part counts as a person in itself. So that's what I do. I think I deny the first premise. What do you think?
I mean, well, you know my feelings on the matter, but I think the analogy at least is like, it really clarifies exactly what you're up to. I just still find the idea of a soul being attached to like another thinking thing. I don't know how the metaphysics works, but that's a story for another day though.
So Tim, you're working on a Four Views debate book on the incarnation. So one of your debate partners affirms a canonic Christology. Could you tell us a bit about canonicism and then maybe lay out an objection to it?
Yeah. Canonic Christology is based on a line in St. Paul's letter to the Philippians. And there he says, Christ emptied himself, taking on the form of a slave. And the emptied word there comes to us from a Greek word, kenosis, I guess is how I know it. that's the place where we get that language from. The kenotic view is a view where Christ empties himself of some features or attributes when becoming incarnate. Now, this emptying is seen in two different ways, a stronger and a weaker way. You might think that Christ emptied himself, that is, he really stopped having these features. He at one point was, say, omnipotent, and then later ceased being omnipotent. And that's sometimes called ontological kenoticism or kenoticism, because it's a real change in the person. A second view is sometimes called functional kenoticism, which is a basic idea that, yeah, he retained his omnipotence during the incarnation, but he refrained from using it at all. So he still got it, he just doesn't use it. So in the ontological view, he's no longer got it. It's a real giving up. The emptying is like actual getting it out of his system. And on the functional view, he still got it, but he stopped using it. That distinction, as an aside before I give the objection, I understand the distinction, and I think I can understand how omnipotence can be this sort of thing you can have but not use, you know, because powers are the sort of things you can have and not use. Each of us can skip right now. We've got the power, but we're not using it.
Right, yeah.
But I don't see how it would work with the functional view for other things. Like, think of omnipresence. I thought to be omnipresent was to be located everywhere in some way or other. And I don't know how you can refrain from using that, but still be omnipresent. So it's hard for me to see how the functional view works for all the attributes which are allegedly given up in the incarnation. Now, what's an objection here to the kenotic view? My preferred objections to it are objections that say it's contrary to the traditional views expressed in the earliest councils of the church. So the kenotic view has it, in either of these two cases, that either the Son really gives up his ruling of the universe, or he doesn't give it up, but he just stops ruling the universe. Or he really gives up his omnipresence or his omnipotence. And I think if you look at the councils, you'll see there's places where they clearly say things that are contrary to this. So for instance, St. Cyril, I talked about him earlier with Nestorius, but St. Cyril in the third ecumenical council, the Council of Ephesus in 431 AD, he writes, quote, "For although visible as a child and in swaddling clothes, even while he was in the bosom of the Virgin that bore him, as God he filled the whole of creation and was fellow ruler with him who begot him." And you find some similar stuff in Leo in his tome from the fourth council. I mean, here, filling all of creation does not sound like it's been given up. And it's clear that it's when he's still in the bosom of the Virgin. The early councils say things such that he really didn't give up these features. And what you find in the councils, I think you also find in the early fathers, too. Now, you know, mileage varies here. So some authors will say, yes, the council said that sort of thing, but we're not beholden to them, and that's okay. And to them, I'm more inclined just to point out to the audience listening that I realize this person is content to not accept the councils, but everybody should know the bill of sale and the costs on the bill. And I think one cost here is jettisoning lots of traditional Christological teaching from the earliest councils.
So I want to make sure I'm following this. So the objection is, you've got two kind of objections. One is, you're going against the councils, and like, they're kind of important, like at least a little bit important, right? And then the second one is, it seems like there's something conceptually confused with the functional account, right? How do you really get omnipresence? If you got the ontological kenosis, they'd just be like, yeah, who cares with that one? I guess they're not going to be too fussed. I want to push back slightly just on the functional one for a second, on omnipresence at least. So it's definitely the case, like, the functional kenosis is not going to get you the councils, so you're going to have to bite the bullet on that. But so I'm looking at the conceptual problem you had. So I don't think omnipresence is an essential divine attribute, because, you know, when God existed all alone prior to creation, however you understand that prior, but that's the traditional understanding of creation ex nihilo, right? He's not going to be present to anything, especially if you think God creates space, then he's literally not present to anything other than present to himself in some metaphorical sense, but not what we mean with omnipresence. Mm-hmm. So if Christ isn't omnipresent, it doesn't matter, because it's not an essential divine attribute. It's like, so who cares?
Yeah. I like the point. I wonder if we can understand omnipresence such that it requires being present to everything that exists, no matter what. In that case that you're talking about, he is, but it's a very tiny, well, tiny is the wrong word for God.
Right.
It's not as much as there is now.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. Because, like, but your standard account of omnipresence usually is cut in terms of causally sustaining everything and knowing everything that you're causally sustaining. So he's present by knowledge and power. And if you're limiting the function of your, or the range of your power and knowledge, then you just, you just are giving up omnipresence in the very process of that. So yeah, so I guess if that's your definition of omnipresence, then I could see why someone would be like, meh, I don't care, Tim, I don't care. But I don't know. Anyway, I've got another question here for you, one final question. It's about methodology. Because so, like we've already talked about here, like you're assuming the authority of the seven ecumenical councils. But a lot of different Protestants, they don't affirm the authority of all seven ecumenical councils. They usually stop after four. They're not even aware of the fact that they're drawing on a lot of resources from number five when they're developing these things. And since I'm a professional theologian, I can say this. Your average theologian doesn't even know which councils are in the list of seven. I'm not going to name and shame people, but I could tell a lot of stories, but I'm not going to. No, we're not going to. We're going to be nice. But imagine, though, that you're listening to someone, like somebody out there listening right now, like they're on the fence about this. They're like, I don't know. Should I just stop with Chalcedon and just have this vague understanding of things because I don't even know what the anathemas are? Or should I like really just go all in with all seven? Like, what would you say to someone to help them recognize that these councils have some kind of authority?
Yeah, that's good. That's big. That's good. So a couple gestures, and maybe we can follow down any of these trails if you'd like. But gesture number one, to my mind, the best view of the authoritative divine testifiers that we have, I think it needs some sort of extra-biblical testifying going on. To my mind, the question of how you get exactly this canon is a super vexing question. And I think it's best answered by having some authoritative structure outside the canon, which can authoritatively testify to the canon. In the Eastern and the Western Church, for at least the first 1,500 years of the Church, this testifying was seen to be done by the ecumenical councils. And so I think you're on good historical and traditional grounds for accepting them. And if you do accept them, you get a nice story. I'm not saying that Nicaea gave us the canon. It didn't. But I'm saying that you have a nice story for how such extra-biblical testifying can occur. So one reason then to accept councils is they're the testifying arm of the Church, and the Church is what gives us the authoritative structure of the canon. A second is pointing out the bad ramifications that would follow if the councils were untrustworthy. So if the councils are untrustworthy, I think it defeats a lot of the settled doctrine that we have. A lot of the reason why all of our later theologians affirmed things about, say, the divinity of Christ or the Holy Spirit was in large part due to the conciliar warrant and testimony from earlier years. And so if you root out the testimony of those councils as in some way authoritative, what you're saying is all of our later theologians that we care a lot about, like Calvin or Aquinas, are people who are laboring under false assumptions. And if they're laboring under false, really important assumptions in their worldviews, we can't take what they say as, you know, good authorities. It's like if we found out Calvin's Bible had like five spurious works, like, you know, bad gospels in it, and that he was basing a lot of his theology on those bad gospels, we'd say, oh, crud, we better stop trusting Calvin for things and start like throw it all to the fire and start anew. And I think if the councils went wrong, you know, back then, there's a lot to throw in the fire and start anew with. And maybe it's just a third reason.
Yeah, go for it.
So for myself, I want my faith to be the faith once handed down by the apostles. That's a goal that I have. And I think if you look at these early councils, they're a great way to tell, to measure or gauge the theology of the time. Here's what I mean. It's very unlikely that all the major sees, like Antioch and Alexandria and Constantinople and Rome and Jerusalem, it's very unlikely that they would all fall into the exact same error at the exact same time. And so if you have people from all over the world getting together and saying, here's what I learned from my forebearers in Rome, and here's what I learned from my forebearers in Nyssa, and they all come together and say they've always been taught P, or whatever it is, some proposition. And then someone comes from elsewhere, like Nestorius, and says, not P. We've got a good reason to believe that P is the thing once handed down. Because after all, the likelihood of just one guy getting it wrong is much higher than the likelihood of all the other C's falling into the same error at the same time. That doesn't say that the councils are infallible, but it does give us some reason to think they're quite trustworthy for giving us a true account of what the universal teaching at the time was concerning the theology. And if you think, you know, the universal teaching in 400 is likely to be strongly related to the teaching once handed down quite a few generations by that point earlier, I think you've got good reason to trust those councils. So those three reasons.
Yeah. No, that seems right to me to say you don't need it to be infallible. You just need authority. That's all I was asking. I'm a bit curious, though, about this last point you had about it's improbable that all these people could get it wrong. And also the claim about universality here. Because we've got tons and tons of bishops who are at this time, like in lots of like religious authoritative figures, affirming wildly different things. I mean, like when you and I were in Scotland, like I never took you to the museum in Edinburgh, but the museum has this huge collection of all these like old Viking like stuff, artifacts and everything. And they're covered with all these Arian hymns because Arianism was so wildly popular. That's what first came over to Scotland. And so like, and Arianism was wildly popular at various points in history. Yeah. I mean, Jerome even says like the world wakes up and groans that it's defined itself Arian. So I guess I'm missing the universality of it and the improbability of like, how could everybody be wrong? And I'm like, it seems like there's a lot of people who were going to be saying, yeah, they were all wrong. Like, I don't know. I feel like I'm missing something here. I don't know if you could help me out just slightly.
I like that question. And I do agree with you historically that there are times when almost everybody's got something wrong. So, and Arianism, I think, is the best one to point to because there are times where there are very few Nicene bishops because of the strong arm of the emperor and so on. And the marauders who had more physical might coming and spreading. In those cases, I do think, though, you can point to the explanation for why there was error there in the emperors and in the marauders. You didn't have that error in the West, or if you did, you didn't have it in Rome. You know, you had it elsewhere. So I guess the point is, we can explain that error in non-theological terms, the might of the emperor, the marauders having power. But with respect to just theological terms, I'd be hard-pressed to find a place in the history of the church where you had it all fall into error, all the C's fall into error, that it can't be accounted for by these other non-theological reasons.
Okay, so you'd be looking at like all the historical work and going, I can explain away this in terms of like the politics or this or that, but when it comes to the councils themselves, I can't do that. That's the strategy.
Yes, I think that's right.
Okay, cool. This is good stuff. Well, Tim, thank you so much for coming on the show today. This has been an absolutely fascinating conversation.
Oh, super fun. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
And there you have it, another episode of the Reluctant Theologian podcast. Stay tuned for more episodes on philosophical theology.